couple of minutes of administrative review. I have the midterms. I intended to return them this morning. I was unable to reach Farouk to confirm that he had made photocopies, so I'm going to make photocopies and I will get them back tomorrow morning. But I do have the roll-up sheets. The midterms actually look pretty good. There's really only one that was any kind of an outlier, and I will send email to that person. Obviously, I'm not going to name them. And also on the slab allocator project, there were two outliers. I think they were actually the same group, and I think we know what's going on with that case, and we already discussed it with them, but again, I'll be following up with that group. But otherwise, everything looked pretty good. There were very, very common... I've learned about Svarup that when you ask him to look at people's C code, you get back lots of comments, not all of which are significant. Some or seven or eight of you have the comment, return value of MMAT, not checked. Okay. Very common error was that people who used the tree used malloc to allocate the nodes to the tree. The whole point of this was we were trying to implement malloc, so that was no. Various people didn't do object caching correctly. And a bunch of people had unnecessary complexity in cache-free. But overall, they were actually pretty good, from what you said. And I'm happy with his scores. Svarup is maybe a more lenient grader than I would be, which is one of the reasons I asked him to grade these. All right, I want to close out a bit of the discussion on virtual machines, because the way it was reported to me, and I obviously wasn't here, sort of one person showed up on Wednesday and became kind of the discussion section, which is great, but the topic on Wednesday ended up not really getting finished. You were the victim.
There were two of us.
There were two of you. Okay. Fair enough. Yeah, he said one person was here and then one person showed up late. So, okay. So the consequence was that he didn't actually get as far as talking about what's going on now in virtualization. And before I switch gears into microkernels, I want to close that out. There's some history here, right? So I know he talked about the 370 and the early hardware virtualization. And virtualization goes very far back. It was used to do machine bring up on early machines. And it's still used for that. Right? AMD contracted with a company called Virtutech to do a very precise simulator for the AMD 64. And that was available to developers long before machines with parts were available, and it allowed people to do most of their operating system bring up. And the consequence of that, when you think about what would happen if you didn't have that, you put a chip on the screen. And in the case of that part, fortunately, it was 32-bit compatible, so you had stuff that ran on it. But even now, there's very little stuff that runs sensibly in 64 bits. Right? And if you were bringing forward a new part that had no compatibility solution, it could easily be a year before there was any software to it. Now, about that year, if you're AMD, the situation is a little better than what I'm about to describe. But if you're a small company, say Transmeta, hypothetically, bringing out a new part, that year means you basically have to be compatible. If you've ever been involved in the venture process, right, the venture capitalist expectation return on investment is 35% per year. Try to get that out of your bank next time you're opening a savings account. Okay. Now, the reason is that a significant percentage of your investments are going to fail. Right? So if you don't have the entire pool of stuff that they invest in, they'll get 20%. From the perspective of the company, that's a loan that you got to pay off. And you got to pay it off in the form of building value in your company that then they cash out with. Right. So the way to think about it is every dollar you spend, right, you're paying 35% interest a year until you pay it back to the investors. So you can imagine spending several $100 million to get a processor to the street and then spending another year waiting around twiddling your thumbs before there was any software for it. That might get expensive. And the several hundred million dollars number is not an exaggeration. In 1990-ish, I was a co-founder of a company that was one of the companies that built the 64-bit Spark part. It was $240 million to get that part to the street. And that was 15 years ago. It's more expensive now. Parts are much more complicated. And part of the problem was we were looking at doing a new architecture. And I didn't understand the economics of venture investment then as well as I do now. Live and learn. Anyway, so there's a long history of using this stuff for new part development, shorten lead time, do things like that. There's also a long history of resistance. Okay, so the 370 was designed specifically in hardware to support virtualization. They had a customer need, and they wanted to be able to subdivide the computer, right? It was a time when not just time sharing, but system leasing was a very common business. Not time sharing in the sense that we use the term today of slicing between multiple users, but time sharing in the sense of leased access to a machine that was being simultaneously used to multiple customers. Many people tried at various times to persuade Intel that virtualization was a good idea. John Crawford at Intel, I think, led the charge away from virtualization and firmly resisted it for many, many years. And probably others as well, but my impression from discussions I've had is that John was the key guy behind this decision. And what I have heard, and I can't say whether it's true, but it's plausible, is that you know there was a perception that Intel was in the processor business and that by not doing virtualization, it had the effect that people bought more processors. Now, this is a historical flip-flop, right? When the chip industry started, the reason you sold processors was to get people to buy memory chips, because the money was in the memory chips. Nowadays, memory chips are a lost product. You sell memory chips to get people to buy processors. Just the economics of the industry is totally flipped. Why? Because if I'm bringing up a new fabrication facility, memory chips are simple, and so the first thing that I produce is memory chips. I do them basically to test my fab, and that means that if I'm competing with people overseas who are bringing up new fabs, the first market to go is the memory market because it's the easiest thing to do. Okay. So Intel resisted for a long time, and when I say resisted, I mean that aside from the virtual 8086, which was a backwards compatibility necessity, there was a period of about 10 years when many people went to Intel and said, you really need to look at virtualization, and Intel basically flipped them the bird. Not always politely. When the processor that's now known as the Itanium, which many of us refer to as the Itanic, was originally designed at Hewlett-Packard. On the day that Hewlett-Packard handed the architecture over, it was virtualizable. Intel fixed that. Mostly virtualizable. There was one instruction that 5 years later, it's now clear, was an issue. Now, the irony is, about 2000, AMD started getting interested in virtualization. I can't say too much about that, except that it started a race. And two things happened at about the same time. One is, it became clear that AMD was going to end up ahead of Intel in defining what would become the 64-bit Pentium architecture. Right? So Intel is now desperately trying to position this right as the N64T instruction set. Right, this is basically Intel's reconstruction of AMD's instruction set. Well, AMD's extensions to the 386. In a very serious sense, Intel lost technological leadership in the 64-bit Pentium, and that's a really big deal. Right? And if you go look at what's happening in the stock market today. Right? Intel stock is basically flat, and AMD stock is coming up. The market is actually starting to realize that there's been a leadership shift. It's been very interesting to watch. If you read the Wall Street Journal, you've seen a lot of news about AMD now. At the same time, so what was going on at AMD? They made a decision that they were going to go into server-grade systems. Okay? And that meant two things in their view. That meant going to 64-bit, because there's a class of database applications, mostly on the server side, really benefits from that. And it meant doing a bunch of technology that was about systems integration. Right? Faster memory architectures, faster bus architectures, the hypertransport stuff, some really good work on multiprocessing, IO and news so that you could tell devices where to move data and you could actually check that they put it where you told them to put it. This is stuff that you need for fault isolation in a large-scale multiprocessor, because one processor does a DMA, it doesn't into the memory of a second processor, and that second processor doesn't know what's going on. That's why you have an IO and MU, is to prevent that. Whole bunch of stuff. And on that feature chart of stuff that AMD committed to was virtualization, at least there were discussions. Now, the initial feeling was virtualization was going to cost too much. Another thing they did was a bunch of pipeline work just to make instruction execution faster. It's astounding. The Pentium 4 is dramatically slower than the competing AMD part. And there's a long list of reasons for that. So AMD started looking at virtualization as early as 2000, probably earlier. There was some initial discussion that I can't say much about. There was concern that virtualization was going to be too expensive. And the question, I think, got moved to, not the back burner, but not the front burner. But it continued to hang around, and it became a competitive issue. And Intel got wind that this was happening and moved very quickly to do it themselves. And it's not clear to me if this is a case of the two groups simultaneously stumbling into the same issue, or Intel desperately playing catch-up against loss of leadership. And I'm inclined to speculate that it was catch-up. So, what has happened now is that this 15-year policy of not doing virtualization in the Pentium family has been reversed. And you can now go to the store and buy a Pentium, if you choose to buy a Pentium, that has what's called VT technology. If you're running Linux, you know this because when it comes up and it lists the processor features, VMX will be in there. Okay. VT originally stood for Vanderpool technology, which was Vanderpool was the internal code name for this stuff. The competing AMD solution, I don't know whether they've actually given it sort of a marketing name, but the competing AMD technology internally was known as Pacifica, and is still known as Pacifica. Now the story is, you can now go to CompUSA, you can buy machines, the Core Duo machines have virtualization technology in them and enabled. The laptops, let me be careful. The Core Duo machines have the virtualization technology, but they are not yet 64-bit machines, right? So the sweet spot here is 64-bit and virtualization enabled. The first Core Duo part that will allegedly have all of those features actually turned on is the T2700, which is supposed to ship in the third quarter of this year. But I happened to notice at CompUSA yesterday that they're doing a manager's special. CompUSA has a rule. They only do a manager's special when they're dumping stock in anticipation of a major turnover, which means those machines are coming.
Is that the Condor you're talking about?
Excuse me?
Is that the Condor you're talking about?
The what?
The new core, the new architecture, the Condor.
No, it's if I may get these two backwards. The current Core Duos are based on something called the Marone Core. The Marone Core is being used in a bunch of their parts right now.
MEROM?
Yeah.
No, I think that is the mobile version of the Condor. The Condor is the desktop. It's the massively out of order chip, and the MEROM is the mobile version. And there's another one.
Okay. What I've heard is actually that desktop core is the same core. I've only seen speculation about this. Real answer to your question.
Yeah, they're basically the same, but they're timed differently. One is optimized for power, one is optimized for performance.
And that could be, and the answer is I don't know. Okay. The core that's coming in the T2700 is the Yona core, and that's the one that's 64-bit and has all this stuff turned on.
Yona's out now. Yona is a version of the Pentium now.
Okay, well then it's Marone that's coming. Now I have it backwards. Yeah. Okay, so the next one that's coming anyway, that's shipping next quarter from Intel, has all this stuff. AMD is also releasing at about the same time. In fact, it's a race who will get to market first, the first generation of their chips that have all of this stuff in them. So the state of the world right now is certain desktop machines, you actually can go buy machines. Now the Pentium D machines, Pentium 4Ds, all have this stuff turned on. So you can buy a desktop machine now. But the interesting part is, by the end of next quarter, you basically won't be able to buy a machine that doesn't do this stuff. And so people who are now looking at certain kinds of products are really unhappy, because if they're starting now, by the time they get to the market, virtualization is a better approach. It's an interesting transition happening. Anyway, so what are the differences between the two? Intel chose to say, we're only going to make it possible to virtualize the protected mode machine. So if you have an operating system, one of the things very early it does a bunch of sort of legacy mode code to go through Bootstrap. It probes the machine, it figures out what disks are attached, figures out where it's going to boot from, all that groovy stuff. All that stuff runs in non-protected mode. There are layers and layers and layers of compatibility and dependency. To make that stuff run under the Vanderpool technology, you have to use a combination of virtual x86 support, some cheating, and some software emulation. IBM has released code to do all of that. The interesting part about the, well, there are several interesting parts, but probably the most interesting part is, how does this machine do address translation? So the story is that it does shadow translation. And the way this works is that as far as the guest operating system is concerned, it loads the translation register, the address space register, in the usual way, and when it reads it, it gets back the answer it thought it loaded. That's not the real address space register. Right? It's a fake. What the operating system does, what that is to say now I'm talking about the virtual machine monitor, is it lets the OS load that. If the loaded value is not an expected value, which is to say one that we were already dealing with, there's a trap made into the virtual machine monitor. Virtual machine monitor then proceeds to do software translation on the address space that's defined by the guest. So the guest thinks it's running on real hardware. The virtual machine monitor essentially walks those page tables, constructs an honest-to-God page table that reflects them, and then allows the guest to proceed as though it really were meant. And there's a new instruction, it's a system call like instruction, that would allow you to do the kinds of facilitation that the Zen paravirtualization can do, right? So the key trick in Zen is that a guest OS that knows it's running on Zen can basically call the VMM and advise it that it's making a page table update. And if you're willing to advise the VMM that you're doing a page table update and sort of play cooperatively, then this shadow translation mechanism is not prohibitively expensive. However, if you're working with a hospital or a legacy OS, it can be made to work. And that's something that Zen currently can't. So that's a mess, or at least you can't do it in its current implementation. And if you look at the spec for the Vanderpool stuff, it looks suspiciously similar. It looks a lot like what they did was they took the microcode that they had for system management mode and extended it. Because if you actually go through the manual, right, there's this 4 kilobyte dump of state that you get when you enter the virtual machine monitor, and there's the 17-page list of bits in it that you better not touch. And what's really going on is the processor is actually taking its internal state, dumping it, and reloading it basically without much re-inspecting it. So in particular, there's some funny states that the virtual machine monitor could, in principle, establish. So internal to the processor, sorry, externally on the Pentium, you can have read-write segments, read-only segments, and executable read segments. You cannot have a segment that is both executable and write. It's just an architectural limit. Inside the processor, it turns out there are three separate bits, execute, read, and write. And all it does is conditionally set them according to which segment you're using. Well, those three bits are dumped to system management mode, and they are dumped to the virtual machine monitor. So in principle, if the virtual machine monitor is willing to tweak that state, it can create segmentation state that the application actually had no way to load. Okay. And the reason I'm suspicious that this stuff borrowed heavily from the system management mode code is that kind of issue. There's internal state that's revealed that there's no way to get to through the official architecture. AMD has gone a slightly different way. And I'm not fully up to speed on what's been done in Pacifica, but I know that there's one important difference. I don't know what they've done with respect to protected mode, I just haven't had time to look. But their approach to translation is quite different. So the Pacifica machine can do two different styles of translation. One is it can do the same kind of shadow translation that the Vanderpool technology can do. But the other is it can do this funny sort of recursive translation. So the idea with the recursive translation is that down at the bottom of the world, you have physical memory. Up at the top of the world, you have virtual memory. This is virtual memory as seen by the guest. Now, the layer of translation that is perceptible to the guest, right? The guest thinks that it's going to physical after translation, but in the Pacifica machine, it's not. In the Pacifica machine, that physical address is then subjected to a second translation step. So, and that second translation step gets you to the honest to God physical address. Here's the piece of this that's a little puzzle.
Okay.
When I say that there's a second stage of translation, I mean every physical address reference, every guest physical address reference, is subject to another layer of translation. And this includes those references that are looking things up from the guest base tables. So if the guest has physical translation, a virtual translation turned off, there still can be a layer of translation going on in the VMM, or rather in the hardware supporting the VMM. Now this is kind of funny, because when you think, how does the translation system work? When I have a 64-bit address space, I have a four-layer hierarchy in the 64-bit address space on the Pentium. Every one of those references gets translated. And then I have a data reference, which also gets translated. So if I start with a completely cold TLD, if I ignore the virtual machine monitor, right, I'm going to do five references, four for translation and one for the data. Each of those references, when I put the virtual machine in Pacifica, if that TLD is really fully cold, each of those references might see five consequential references. Right? Because I had to do five to do the upper layer translation. If the TLD was really cold, each of those in turn had to be five in the lower level. There may be 25 memory references to load a word if the TLD is cold. Right? It's an exponential growth. Now, why would I want to do that? One, the TLD isn't usually cold.
Is the TLD written out with that processor state?
No, on both of these machines now, the TLBs are tagged. And so the TLBs are not unloaded quite so aggressively as they used to. One of the things that EMD did in some of the parts that are already shipping is they have a second level TLB that's actually managed in the data cache. And they have some backward tracking stuff. So you may flush the TLB. The processor is actually smart enough to watch in the data cache to see if that location's actually been modified. It doesn't actually accept the flush unless the location's been modified. And it tags the TLB with the value of the address space register so that it doesn't make mistakes about which entry to use. So effectively, the address you think you're giving to the TLB is concatenated with the value of the address space register. And that makes it globally unique. And then the TLB is globally shared. Alright, so the thought is, look, the TLB isn't cold, one. Two, the VMM is stupid, it's going to use large page mapping, so some of these levels are going to go away. Three, if I have to handle a hostile OS, that is, one that's not going to play nicely with me about translation, you know, 25 references sounds pretty bad, but if I have to do it with shadow translation, it's going to be a lot more than that. I'm going to have to take a whole page fault. And every time the guest modifies a page table, I'm going to have to invalidate the corresponding page table in the virtual machine monitor, so I no longer know that it's up to date. So the overhead of this is actually tremendous. In the VAX VMM work, They did some measurement, and their conclusion was the shadow translation accounts for a 50% overall loss in performance. Some of that was particular to bats. Some of that was that doing shadow translation well is actually quite hairy. I haven't looked at the MaxVMM implementation, but it's there's an art to it, and I don't have. They were very smart people, but it's one of these things you have to stare at for a long time, and the project didn't actually run for that long. Well, if you believe that you can't get, so there's only one OS, pragmatically speaking, that won't play nice, potentially, and that's Windows. You have to remember that both of these technologies were developed in collaboration with Microsoft. Okay, so turns out, when the Zen work was initially released, when that paper was published, Paul Barham, who worked for Microsoft, almost lost his job. Paul was one of the primary authors. It turns out there had been a project going on inside Microsoft that the Cambridge Research Group had not known anything about, which was commercially working on developing a very similar virtual machine. And the publication of the Zen paper caused about 25 patents that Microsoft was gearing up to file to be invalidated. So the product group was ready to kill these guys. One may speculate that part of what was going on there was that Microsoft actually was already in early discussions with Intel, right, and had some idea what was coming in the hardware, and they were exploring paravirtualization, partly to answer the question, well, under the assumption of paravirtualization, shadow translation may be good enough. And the answer turns out to be yes, and we know that from the Zen work. Not only is it good enough, it's quite good indeed. And did Swarup explain why it is that this paravirtualization, why this page table update thing is such a mess? Did you have a chance to do that? Looking for a yes or a no. Okay. Do you understand why it is that the page table update thing is such a mess in shadow translation? You don't shadow translation. Who's awake? You're awake. See, now you get into these rooms. Everybody else in the planet wants to start. He's awake, but I gotta wake up. Alright, here's the mess. I have a guest. It has built a page table. Now, I can't run out of that page table because that page table points to physical pages, and I don't know that they're real. They might point into some other guest. So what I do is I cheat. And I create the illusion in the eyes of the guest that it's really running on this page table. I either do it through software translation, or I do it through shadow registers, or some hardware technique, or, but basically the guest can't tell what I'm about to say. Now, what happens is the guest goes to reference an address, and it effectively traverses part of the page table, right? That's happening in the TLB. Well, no. What's really going on is that the VMM has introduced a substitute page table tree. And in this substitute tree, let's imagine this reference hasn't been done before. So what's really going on is we're traversing a path in the substitute tree, and we get to a leaf entry that's invalid because we've never seen this before. What happens in this case is we page fault. We page fault into the VMM. The VMM reaches back into the guest page tables. It knows this because it simulated the instruction that loads the page table address for the master address space register. It walks these tables by hand in software. It determines whether the target physical address is valid. And if it is, it builds a corresponding entry in the VMM tables. Right? And if this looks like the node tree to page table tree translations, because it is, right? We just have the special convenience here that all of these page tables are in some sense compatible. The size of the page tables on the left is the same as the size of the page tables on the right. That means we can rely on some congruencies, which are helpful to have. So this is the simplest case of this kind of thing. So now the VNM has shadowed this entry, right? And it allows execution to proceed. And now the load restore instruction will resume. It'll re-execute its traversal. It'll find a valid entry. So far, so good. Not so fast. We have a problem. This shadow is a cache of state from the guest tree. So we have to know if the state in the guest tree gets changed. We have to know. So what we have to do, now this is subject to the statement that we're doing shadow translation without hardware support. The various kinds of hardware support that can make this much more pleasant. Is we have to say, I need to know when any data in that page changes. What mechanism can we use to do that? The guest thinks that this is in physical memory. It's not. It's in the virtual space of the virtual machine monitor. So what we're going to do is mark this page read-only. Now, marking that page read-only is expensive because now we potentially have to shoot things down with TLB. Okay, so now what will happen is if the guest should touch this page again, we have two choices. In fact, what's going to happen is we're going to find out, because it goes to the store instruction, we're going to find out before the store instruction completes. Because the fault happens before the actual write. So what we're going to have to do is when the guest touches this page, we will throw away everything in our corresponding shadow page. Throw away meaning we'll make them all invalid. Why? Well, we don't know where the store is going to go. And once we revalidate this page for writing, there could be multiple stores in this page, so other entries could get invalidated too. So we're going to end up ping-ponging this page, right? One state is it is writable to the guest, and we will not interpret it as valid for addresses. And the other is we're being forced to interpret it as valid for addresses, and therefore we have to make it read-only to the guest. And we're going to flip it back and forth between these two states. Every one of these splits involves a page fault, it involves whacking a TLB, it involves updating permissions, and it involves throwing away a whole bunch of mappings. Because what's the usual pattern? This page table that's being modified, it's the one that points to the heap. And we're growing the heap. We're growing the heap one, two, three pages at a time. And when we invalidate our shadow of this page table, we are invalidating every mapping in the heap. You might imagine that might be expensive. Right? So it's exactly the pathological case. And every one of those entries that we invalidated, we're going to have to take a page fault to revalidate. So if you have a program that's growing its heap quickly, this could easily come to be a very significant overhead. There are many tricks in the Zen system. There's only one, in my opinion, that actually matters. Arguably two. So the original idea of the Zen system was they came up with a clever way to share these page tables so they didn't actually have to be shuttled. Sitting underneath that was a new system call. It was a system call that the guest operating system used to call virtual machine owner. So here's the idea. When the guest operating system wants to do a store in this page, why do we have to do this read-only garbage? Because we had to know that the store was happening. Well, suppose the guest operating system would merely consent to tell us. Then we don't have to do any of this invalidation. So if the guest operating system would say, that page, it's a mapping page. Please store this word at this location in that page. Give me a system call. Well, then we could validate the one word and just do the update directly, and we wouldn't have to do any of this invalidating nonsense. Furthermore, It often turns out that an operating system does a whole bunch of these writes at the same time in a single operation, but it doesn't really need any of them eagerly. So you can bash them. You can say to the MM, okay, I have 15 updates to various page tables I want to do. Here's the list of 15. Please go apply them. And that saves on system call program. That's the innovation in the Zen system that's really, really cool. In fact, if you look at the difference from Zen 1 to Zen 2, in Zen 1 they were reusing the page tables without shadowing. By Zen 2, they started to look at migration. When you do migration, you have to do shadow page tables again. The real value here is in that system call that's the advisory page table. Okay. So, in the VT design, you're committed to shadow paging, and you better get some help from the guest. And not surprisingly, the VT virtual machine monitor system call looks suspiciously like what you would need if you were trying to do a Zen system that was hardware supported. And that's not an accident. It was designed cleverly. The Pacifica design was trying to anticipate things like Windows not moving. And one may speculate that this is because the relationship between AMD and Microsoft is not as close as the relationship between Microsoft and Intel. I like it mostly because on the Pacifica, right, I can bring up a legacy operating system that for some reason I still want to support. Right, it doesn't want to cooperate with me and I don't want to rebuild, and I can run it. I can do it in the Vanderpool stuff as well, it's just going to be slower. Okay. All this stuff will be shipping by the end of the next quarter in laptops. Like, you won't be able to buy a laptop that's only 32-bit anymore, really. I mean, you know, very low end, right? But nobody will buy it. They'll go away quickly. And you basically won't be able to buy a laptop or desktop that does not support virtualization. This will move into the servers quickly. It's already showing up in server machines, but those new cores, for a variety of reasons, are shipping in the laptops and desktop machines first. So one of the things this changes is how I think about sort of defensive security technology, things like firewalls, things like virus detection, things like kernel rootkit protection. I have a client who's working on an HS-ARPA contract to do a drop-in PCI board that basically reaches into your machine and scans memory to test if the kernel has been penetrated. Right? By the time this board could possibly be delivered to customers, it would be the wrong way to do it. Because if you think about the clock, to get that board into the field, it's about an 18-month clock. The replacement cycle on laptops is about 3 years, right? So if this stuff actually ships next month or two, which is what's expected, by the time that board gets to the field, 50% of the customers have already moved to machines where this technology is available. Those are the same 50% who would be the early adopters of your car. Right. So you're in this race and you're basically never catch up. And I'm actually trying to get them to reposition it as a virtualization story. And that's an interesting story because there are a few major companies that are potentially interested in this story, who I won't name for obvious reasons. Okay, questions about virtualization. What I'm going to do tomorrow, so I can hand you back an intern, is I'm going to switch gears into the microkernel discussion, which is sort of the stuff that I work on these days. And that will be the topic for the rest of this week. Early next week, we'll do some exam review. Somebody asked me, would there be another project? The answer is no. For a variety of reasons, I did not get the next project ready to go. I had a bunch of surgery done over the course of this semester that disrupted things unbearably. So we're not going to do another project. We'll just do a final exam. Okay, questions on virtual machines?
So a lot of the problems we're having on this set of your shadow paging was because you are having the faults, which is probably because you have a bunch of different virtual machines all working.
No.
So if you
anytime any guest updates its page table, we have to guarantee that the virtual machine monitor's cache is conservatively consistent. That's the source of the problem.
But how does the host VM apply it. Like, doesn't Xen run with Xen as a base and then a host that helps control Xen and then it has guests on top of that?
The host isn't in this picture. This is all done in the VM.
Okay, so how is the host affected in terms of by the VM? Like, is it almost not at all?
Okay, the Xen host, and this is not unique to Xen, this is done in a lot of virtual machines. It's a little confusing. So from one perspective, the host is just another guest. Okay, all of the translation mechanism works the same way. The reason you have a host is you need something to administer with. And in the Xen story, we need something to provide device drivers. Life was easier in the 370 because there are only three or four devices on the 370. The channel architecture is simplified. So typically what happens is virtual machine zero is given privilege that's not available to other virtual machines. It's entitled to speak to devices directly. And what you do is for the other virtual machines, instead of giving them a real Ethernet card, you give them a software-defined Ethernet card. And there's some kind of inter-process communication that reflects requests back to the host. The host basically simulates the devices so that the virtual machine itself doesn't have to. But with respect to translation, host zero is just another guest, or guest zero.
So then my question is, how is performance affected against the host by being another guest but with privileges? Is it still a significant performance hit?
Oh yeah, the guest pays all guests, including guest zero, pay the translation related overhead.
Okay. So it's still not really feasible to build an operating system that was just virtualized by default when it's installed. You know, so it's not at the point where you would do that even if you're gonna have just one machine. You only do that if one that has multiple versions.
Now I think you're asking a different question. Let me give you the other half of the story, right? So the story is if the guest is not virtually aware, then the overhead could be quite high. If the guest is virtualization aware and is willing to make these special system calls, the overhead can be put down into the 1.5% to 3% range. That's low enough that you don't notice. And remember, most of the time of a real system is spent in application code. That's largely unaffected. And the question I think you're asking is, well, why don't I just compile operating systems to be aware of this all the time? Is that where you're going?
Well, where I was going exactly was, in the next couple of years, are operating systems going to ship that are innately virtual?
Yes, in fact, they're already shipped.
Okay.
Fedora in releases 4 and 5 has been shipping Xen-enabled kernels. You have to do some extra stuff to install them, and as far as I can tell, they still don't work, but in principle, they're trying. They have a product management problem in that area. I shouldn't speak too loudly since I'm one of the people supposed to be fixing it. My cup gets free time. Microsoft already has two virtualized versions of Windows. One was done by Paul Barham to demonstrate that Windows could be run on top of Xen. The other, we can speculate from that patent debacle that there was a product group working on a similar thing. So the right question to ask is, well, given that it's only 1.5% to 3%, why wouldn't I do the following? Suppose what I do is I ship a specialized hypervisor. This hypervisor only implements one guest. And its sole job is to do the mapping management. Right? It's only ever going to run guest zero, right? The trusted guest. Its sole job is to do the mapping management so that I can only compile one version of my kernel. And instead of trying to compile two versions of my kernel, I'll compile the one that's always virtualization enabled, right? And I'll then have this stub that provides that extra stuff. Right? Think of this as a strangely implemented part of the hardware abstraction. Yeah, could be done. Could very easily be done. And I don't know that it needs to be done, but it's certainly feasible. On the other hand, it's not that hard to compile your OS to it. And guest zero versus the rest are going to have to load different device drivers anyway. So at the end of the day, There's no way you're going to get out of managing multiple variations of your kernel. This is just one more little comment on the end of listed variations. So I'm not honestly sure how much it helps. If you're the Fedora project, apparently it would help a lot because managing one kernel is already at the limits of what your project team can pragmatically handle. I want to be clear, I'm not trying to be snotty about the Fedora project team. Managing one kernel is a beastly hard job, and the Xen thing throws a real wrench into the works as far as they're concerned, and rightly so. I'm irritated because I'd actually like to be using this stuff, and I've learned that it's not stable enough to be in production. But one has to acknowledge it's a very, very hard job. Did that answer your question?
Okay.
Other questions on virtualization?
Is Xen only designed to be run directly on the hardware with the guest zero and the device talking, or can you also run like VMware on top of an operating system?
Okay, so you're digging in. Let me generalize your question a little bit. Let me rephrase the question in a pejorative way. Having done a truly overwhelming amount of work to make the Pentium virtualizable, was Intel stupid enough not to learn their lesson, such that the virtualization is not itself virtualizable? I mean, if you get the virtualization right, you want to be able to run a VT machine on the bottom that runs a guest that thinks it's running a VT machine. And we've only known how to do that for 30 years. The answer is, I don't think they did it. Certainly nobody's tried. It would be an interesting exercise to find out where did they bury themselves. In the answer to your question, VMware is strange. VMware actually doesn't rely on any hardware support. As far as the VT stuff is concerned, it looks just like part of the OS, the interesting parts. So there's no reason to believe that VMware should have any difficulty running on top of Vanderbilt. Now, there are now shipping some versions of VMware that if you're running an OS sitting on top of that stuff, it'll turn it on and make use of it. And that one, I think, will not virtualize recursively, because I think that they did not get recursive virtualizability done right. And that's a problem, because Microsoft is moving to ship a VMM with Windows, and what that means is you're not going to get to control it. And we're just going to do this again. But hell, there's always more transistors. Anyway, I should let you go. We'll come back tomorrow. I will hand out midterms.